But Malik was not only responsible for tying religious liberty closely to the inner freedom of conscience, he also insisted that this right must include the right to change one's religion. As is well known, the explicit mentioning of this right triggered protests of several Middle Eastern states and eventually caused Saudi Arabia to abstain from voting on the declaration in its entirety. But I would argue that these protests were not legitimized in reference to the ban on apostasy in Islamic law. On the contrary, these states focused on how Christian missionaries throughout history had abused this very right as a means to stir up religious emotions and to pave the way for political intervention. And as I see it, in the naming of Christian missionaries as sort of the fathers of the right to change one's religion in the UDHR, they were not completely fallacious. In his quest for the right to change one's religion, Malik namely joined forces with the International Ecumenical Movement, which was highly active during the drafting of the declaration, and which dedicated almost all its attention to the articulation of religious liberty. Although this work had a long prehistory, it was intensified during the 1940s by the American-based Joint Committee on Religious Liberty, which in 1944 distributed a broad statement on religious liberty to members of the American Congress, to churches, and to the broader American public. And as you see, the right to change one's religion is included in this statement. A year later, the same organization published Searle Bates' momentous book, Religious Liberty, An Inquiry, which is a 600-page overview of the contemporary historical problems of religious liberty, as well as its philosophical and theological roots. The book opens with three chapters dedicated to what Bates then considered to be the most acute problems of religious liberty in the world, and that was Soviet Russia, Franco's Spain, and the Muslim countries. And the Muslim countries reoccurs throughout his book as a straw man that helps to define religious liberty by way of negation. Orthodox Islam, Bates argues, is the contrary of religious liberty and finds no room for the concept as developed in Western lands. In a later passage, Bates also confirms that the ecumenical movement's early efforts on specifying the necessary components of religious liberty were done in the light of, quote, the social, religious, political pressures for uniformity in Mohammedan societies, unquote. Seen in this light, I think that it's fair to construe the reaction of Middle Eastern states to the content of Article 18 not as a repudiation of some self-evident form of religious liberty, but as a reply to an active provocation. Thus, what I've been trying to show is that the articulation of religious liberty in the UDHR, in all its vagueness, has a very complex history and cannot be explained along the same lines as human rights in the more abstract meaning of the term. Instead, I've suggested three political currents during the late 1940s that all influenced different components of this articulation of religious liberty. And first, the decision to raise all institutional aspects of religious liberty could partly be explained within Mazzao's thesis that human rights really gained the political attractiveness of in the 1940s as an antithesis to the minority rights system. And moreover, the stress on the inner dimensions of conscience and belief, as opposed to free practice or freedom of worship, as Franklin D. Roosevelt famously phrased this right, is best seen in the light of the personalist conception of human rights. And finally, the freedom to change one's religion has, I would argue, its origins in the experiences of Christian missionaries in the Middle East, which were transformed to political action in the hands of the international ecumenical movement. So this is not really a critique of these new histories of human rights, but more of a reminder that I think it's important to think of a document like the UDHR not as a stable entity, nor as equatable to the sort of human rights idea, but as a compilation or a patchwork of many different components, and all of which have their own historical traditions. Thanks.
All right, so I will just make a couple comments. I had a lot of them, and then I realized, you know, the time frame, so I'll just sort of pick and choose, and hopefully we can have a conversation afterwards. But I want to thank all three of the presenters for really fascinating papers, and especially the paper versions. I think all of you bring the question, you raise the question of the stakes of the moral and morality. And of course, this may seem like a very obvious move when we're talking about human rights, or work dealing with human rights, but it seems to me that a lot of recent work on human rights and humanitarianism, you know, starts from a realist position that treats the moral in solely instrumental terms. And I think you all take seriously the moral meaning and weight of rights and protections, while you, at the same time, you don't shy away from the way in which the moral remained bound up with the paternalism and inequalities of empire, for example. But you also don't adopt this kind of utterly cynical view that makes the triumph of human rights appear so strange for some actors, and only ultimately understandable as an expression of the interests of sovereign states. I think there's a lot of space in between those two positions, and all of you are thinking very carefully about that. So I'll just raise a couple of questions and comments for each paper in turn. So Carolyn, you and I obviously have a lot of common interests in the sense of pushing at the limits of what we might call refugee history or refugee studies, what appear to be very interesting or critical moments of in the history of displacement, which is maybe the more proper term, haven't been incorporated into broader genealogy of use of refuge and asylum and the refugee. You very nicely insert, especially in the longer version, this account of debates about refuge in the British imperial context into refugee history, which is a nascent field, much less developed as a kind of coherent field than the history of human rights, for example. But this is a question that emerged in the conversation earlier. I mean, I do have a question about where this fits in broad histories with broader histories of humanitarianism and human rights. And I was thinking about the way that the history of the British abolition of the slave trade and abolitionism has been so important for one strand of human rights history that argues, right, that the genealogy of human rights is in the 19th century around that. So thinking about, you know, why your story about these former slaves is forgotten in certain literatures and not in others, and thinking about the disconnects between different strands of what we might call human rights history, it's a question. It seems it's not clear that this is all human rights history for all of us.